on the door handle. I forgot something. Surely it can wait, she said. It can't.
Then I'll drive you back.
No.
Simon, said Penny seriously.
What's this about?
I opened the door. I need to go back and make sure that Baz is okay.
Baz is fine,
Agatha insisted as I climbed out. He's not fine. We just found out that he was in a coffin for 6 weeks. They were leaning into each other between the front seats, turned completely around to shout at me.
Penny, he's fine now.
Agatha, get back in the car. I put my hand on the door and bent over so I could see them. He shouldn't be alone right now.
He isn't,
they both said. I should keep an eye on him. I stood up again.
We'll drive you back,
Agatha said. No, you'll be late for Christmas Eve. Go. I shut the door, turned around, and immediately started to run. I didn't think rich people actually ate this way. At a long table covered with red and gold cloth, thick napkins tied with poinsettias, platters with heavy silver lids. It wouldn't surprise me if rich people really don't live like this, but that the pitchers do it just to make a scene. If this is Christmas Eve, what do they have planned for tomorrow?
Sorry we're late, Mother, Baz says, pulling out a chair.
What a nice surprise, Mr. Snow, his dad says. He's smiling, but in a way that makes me regret my decision to come back.
Thank you, sir. I hope I'm not intruding.
Baz's stepmom smiles.
Of course not.
I can't tell if she means it, or is just being polite.
I invited him, Baz says to his father. It's not like he has anywhere else to go at Christmas.
I can't tell if Baz is actually being rude to me or doing it for show. I can't read any of their faces. Even the baby just looks bored. I thought there might be extended family here for the holidays, miscellaneous Grimms and Pitches, but it's just Baz's parents and his siblings. There's the older girl, Mordelia, then two other little girls, maybe twins. I'm not sure how old enough to sit up by themselves and gnaw on turkey legs. And the baby, in a fancy carved high chair, tapping a rattle onto her tray. They all look like Baz's stepmom. Dark hair, but not black like Baz's, with round cheeks and those Billy Piper mouths that don't quite close over their front teeth. They don't look dangerous enough to be Baz's siblings, or his father's children. Penny says the Grimms are less political and less deadly than the Pitches, but Baz's dad looks like a pit viper wearing a pinstripe suit. Even his snow-white hair is scary.
Stuffing? Baz asks, handing me a platter.
It seems like their servants have the day off. I've counted at least four since I've been here. Vera, two women cleaning, and a man out front shoveling the walks. I take a big scoop of chestnut stuffing and notice that there's almost nothing on Baz's plate. The platters and boats go around twice, and he just passes them to me. I wonder if he has an eating disorder.
I eat enough for both of us. The food here is even better than at Watford.
Did you ever believe in Father Christmas? Baz asks. He's laying out blankets and pillows for me on his couch. His stepmother brought them up after Baz explained that I didn't want to sleep in the guest room. He's afraid of the wraiths, he told her. That made his little sisters giggle. They were eager to get to bed so that Father Christmas could get here.
Did you tell Father Christmas that you'd be here?
Mordelia asked me.
So that he can send you presents?
I didn't, I told her. I should have. I don't think so, I tell Baz now. I mean, sometimes the home would get somebody to dress up like Father Christmas and hand out crap gifts, but I don't remember believing in him.
What about you?
I believed in him, Baz says. And then, the year after my mother died, he didn't come. He throws me a pillow and walks over to a tall wooden chest of drawers. I thought I'd been very, very bad. But now I think my dad was probably just depressed and forgot about Christmas.
Fiona showed up later that day with a giant stuffed Paddington.
The bear. There's nothing wrong with Paddington Bear. Here.
He's holding out some pyjamas. His pyjamas. I take them. Baz sits at the end of his bed and leans against one of the posts.
So, you came back.
I sit next to him.
Yeah.
He's still wearing his dark green suit. He slicked his hair back for dinner.
I wish he wouldn't do that. It looks better when it's loose and falling around his face.
We can go talk to the Numpties tomorrow, he says.
On Christmas Day?
Do Numpties celebrate Christmas?
I don't know.
He cocks his head. I didn't really get to know them. According to the books, they don't do much but eat and try to stay warm.
What do Numpties eat?
I ask.
Rubble, he says, as far as anyone can tell. Maybe they just chew on it.
Do you think Penny is right?
That it was your mother's murderer who hired the Numpties?
Baz shrugs.
It would make sense. And Bunce is usually right.
You sure you can handle going back there?
He looks at his knees.
I'd rather talk to the Numpties than go back to Nicodemus, and those are our only two leads.
I still wish we had a motive, I say. Why would someone want to hurt your mother?
I'm not sure they did want to,
Baz says. What if the target was the nursery, not my mother?
There's no way of knowing that she'd be the one who came. Maybe the vampires wanted to take the children. Maybe they wanted to turn us all.
He's rubbing his hand along the top of his thigh. His legs are longer than mine. That's where all his height is.
I'm not a very good boyfriend, I say.
Baz's hand settles on his trouser leg and tugs. He sits up straighter.
I understand, Snow. Trust me, I'm not planning our next mini-break. I'm not even going to tell anyone about us.
No, I say, turning slightly towards him. That's not what I mean. I mean, I've always been a terrible boyfriend. That's why Agatha broke up with me. I basically just did what I thought she wanted me to, but I always got it wrong, and I never put her first. I never once felt like I was getting it right in 3 years.
Then why did you stay together?
Well, I wasn't going to break up with Agatha. It wasn't her fault.
He's smoothing his hand along his leg again. I like everything about Baz in this suit.
I'm just saying, I say, turning a bit more, that I don't know how to be your boyfriend, and I don't think you'd want that from me.
Fine, he says. Understood. And I know that you think we're doomed, Romeo and Juliet style.
Completely, he says to his knees. And I don't think I'm gay, I say. I mean, maybe I am, at least partly, the part that seems to be demanding the most attention right now.
No one cares whether you're gay, Baz says coldly.
I'm sitting sideways now, facing his profile. His eyes are narrow and his mouth is a straight line.
What I'm saying is, my voice fades out.
Oh, I suck at this.
I like to look at you.
His eyes shoot over to me, and he lowers his eyebrows but doesn't turn his head.
I like this, I go on. All of this that we've been doing?
He ignores me.
I like you, I say. And I don't even care that you don't like me. I'm used to it. I wouldn't know what to do if you did. But I like you, Baz. I like this. I like helping you. I like knowing that you're okay. When you didn't come back to school this autumn, when you were missing, I thought I was going to lose my mind.
You thought that I was plotting against you, he says.
Yeah, I say. And I missed you.
He shakes his head.
There's something wrong with you.
I know. But I still want this, if you'll let me have it.
Baz finally turns to look at me.
What's this, Snow?
This, I say. I want to be your boyfriend, your terrible boyfriend. He cocks an eyebrow and stares at me, like figuring out what's wrong with me is something he'll never have enough time for. There's a soft knock at the door. Baz stands up, straightening his suit, and walks to the door. He opens it and leans over, picking up a tray, then brings it back to his bed. There's a pitcher of milk and a heavily laden plate from dinner. "Who's that from?" I ask. "My stepmother." "Why didn't you just eat at dinner?" "I don't like eating in front of people," he says. "Why not? Why do you ask so many questions? Is it anorexia?" "No, Snow, it's not anorexia. Do you even know what that means?" He sits on the far side of his bed and takes the napkin off the tray, shaking it unfolded. "My fangs pop when I eat," he says. "It's noticeable." I crawl across the bed to sit next to him. "I didn't notice the other night when you ate in front of me." "Well, you're not very observant, are you?" "Or maybe it's not as noticeable as you think." Baz looks up at me, and his cheeks look fuller than normal. He smiles then, and I see them, long white fangs trying to push out over both his lips. "Wicked," I whisper, trying to look closer. He pushes me back, but not far. "Open your mouth again," I say. "Let me see." He sighs and pulls back his lips. His fangs are huge, and they look sharp. "Where do they come from? Like, where do they go when you're not using them?"
"I don't know."
He sounds kind of like he's wearing braces. "Can I touch them?"
"No."
"They're sharp and toxic." "I can't believe there's a part of your body that grows when you need it. You're like a mutant."
"I'm a vampire," Baz says. "And can you hear yourself?"
I sit back. "Yeah." I expect him to look aggravated, and he does, but he's also kind of smiling around his fangs. I hand him his plate. Turkey, stuffing, bacon, lashings of gravy. He takes it.
"Are you still hungry, Snow?"
"I could eat."
"Come on, then."
He hands me the fork and keeps the spoon for himself. The turkey's so tender, the spoon works fine. He takes a huge bite, and I see the full length of his fangs. "Wicked," I say again. Baz shakes his head.
"You're an idiot,"
he says with his mouth extra full. He looks down at his plate.
"But you can have this, if you want it."
"I do." 68. Agatha. It's a 3-hour drive back to London. Penelope casts Time Flies, but neither of us are having any fun, so it doesn't work. I've half a mind to drive straight to Watford to tell the mage everything, but my parents were expecting me hours ago, and honestly, I don't relish the thought of talking to the mage by myself. He's not exactly approachable. He's always dressed like Peter Pan, and he carries a sword, like all the time. Once, he showed up at our door in the middle of the night with his ear in his hand. Dad had to sew it back on. I've known the mage since before I was in school. He and Dad have been on the coven together forever. But I'm not sure the mage even knows my name. I've never heard him say it. He never really speaks to me. Penny says he's a sexist, but the facts are that the mage hardly talks to anyone at Watford, not even Simon. I don't get why he wants to be headmaster. Does he even like kids? Maybe that's why Lucy broke it off with him. Or maybe he's such a prat because she broke up with him and he never got over it. I still have that photo in my handbag. I hope Penny's mum doesn't realize I stole it. I really hope she doesn't tell my parents. I went through a shoplifting phase when I was 14 and got grounded for an entire summer when my parents found my stash of unopened eyeliners and nail varnish.
"We would buy you cosmetics,"
my father said. "You didn't use magic?" my mother asked. "You just took it?" And then she said, "Oh, Agatha, purple varnish, how common." Penny only lets me ignore her for 20 minutes or so before she bursts. "I thought you'd want to be included, Agatha." "You didn't," I say. "I did. I could tell you missed Simon. I could tell you were sad.
Are you really saying you'd rather we just left you out and ignored you for the rest of the year? No. Then what? Agatha, what do you want? I want to be friends, I say. But I don't want to be, like, comrades in arms. I don't want to have secret meetings. I just want to hang out. Like, make biscuits and watch telly. Do normal friend stuff. We're supposed to watch telly while Simon fights the humdrum and Baz gets kidnapped by numpties. No! I lean forward, squeezing the steering wheel. In the scenario I'm describing, none of that would be happening. But it is happening! Well then, yeah, I think I would rather just stay home. Because I can't actually do anything to help. When have we ever been any help, Penelope? Like, real help? We're just witnesses and hostages and, like, future collateral damage. If we were in a movie, one of us would have to die while Simon watched. That's all we're good for. Speak for yourself, she shouts. I will, I shout back. But neither of us speaks for the rest of the trip. I drop Penny off at her house, and she's still so pissed off that she slams the car door. I'm really late, but my parents are so busy getting ready for their party, they hardly notice when I walk in. They do a travelling party every Christmas Eve. It starts at one house, then moves on to the next house, then the next, until everyone's so trolleyed they have to spell the cars to drive them home. Simon and I are always expected to say hello when the guests get here. Then we hide in the lounge and watch telly and eat hors d'oeuvres until we fall asleep by the fire. Except for once, 4 years ago, when we snuck out on Christmas Eve to track werewolves through Soho. They'd stolen some key or maybe a gem. I can't bloody remember. I've never been colder in my life. We nearly died outside Liberty. And then, after it was finally over, Penny made us stay out and collect werewolf fur so that she can make these grotesque premenstrual talismans. I gave mine to the cat. Wait, the moonstone. That's what it was. The werewolves stole the moonstone. What a load of rubbish. Thank magic we were back before my parents got home. Should I tell Mum now? What I know? What Simon is up to? No, Simon will be fine. Simon is always fine, and Penny will love bragging to me about their adventures with the numpties. Maybe Baz is their new third wheel. Have fun hanging out with a vampire, Simon. Good job making your life even more stupid and dangerous. I think you can come along with us tonight, my mother says. She and Helen, our housekeeper, are getting things set up. Her house is first on the party circuit this year. Since you don't have Simon to entertain, Mum...
Don't whine, Agatha,
my father says, plucking a crab claw from a platter. He's on the phone with a patient.
No, I'm listening, Balthazar. But it all sounds quite normal. No, I don't mean normal. I mean normal.
I sigh and follow my mother into the kitchen. But I'm not dressed for a party.
Then get dressed.
Mum, I'm knackered. She's leaning into the refrigerator.
You'll get your second wind.
Is Simon coming round tomorrow, then? I frown and fidget with a tray of prawn cocktails. I don't think so. I already told her that Simon was spending Christmas at Watford, but somehow Mum got it in her head that he would still stop by here on Christmas Day. It's tradition, I suppose. Maybe I should feel guilty for disinviting him. But I don't. I tried to take it back tonight. Mum stands up, holding a sparkling tiered jelly. I think it's good that he's spending holidays with the mage, she says. As far as I can tell, the mage usually spends Christmas alone at Watford. He told me once that the holidays were too auspicious to waste on festivities. What does that mean? I ask. Oh, who knows? She says, handing the jelly off to Helen. I hope Simon doesn't end up fasting by moonlight. We'll have to stuff him with sweetmeats tomorrow. Auspicious, I say. Why is the mage such a weirdo? Hush, Agatha, don't be treasonous. I'm not. I'm just saying, was he always like this? I wouldn't know, she says, We certainly never travelled in the same circles. I can't even remember him from school. I reach for a prawn, but Helen takes the tray away. Do you remember Professor Bunce? I ask Mum. From school. Which one? Either. Martin and Mitali were a few years behind me, Mum says. She's getting out another pudding, a huge, stacked trifle. But don't they have a son even older than you? They started popping them out awfully early. That's the Bunce influence, I think. I went to Watford with a litter of Bunces, not a one of them powerful enough to be there. That happens, you know, in big families. The magic gets watered down. My mother is obsessed with power. Who's got it? Who doesn't? She doesn't, at least not much. She blames her own mother for marrying down. My father couldn't light a match in a rainstorm. I'm adequate, magically speaking. I'm no Simon, or Baz, or Penelope. But I get through my lessons just fine. I know that's why my parents never had more kids after me. They didn't want my magic to be diluted, even though Dad says it's an old wives' tale that siblings split magic. I also know that my parents are hoping I'll marry someone more powerful than I am to get the family back on course. Before I started dating Simon, I had a secret normal boyfriend, Sasha. If my mother had known, she would have locked me in a tower. She probably would have taken away my horse. I wonder what Sasha's doing these days. So, you wouldn't have known their friends, I ask. Professor Bunce mentioned someone named Lucy. She showed us a photo. Lucy Day? I'm not sure. Lucy McKenna? She was Professor Bunce's best friend, I say. Butterscotch blonde, hair down to her waist. Sort of a boho nouveau look. Darling, Mum says, helping Helen lift the trifle. That was everyone in the 90s. She looked like Baby Spice, I say, but with big shoulders. Oh, Lucy Salisbury. Hell's spells, I haven't thought of her in years. Mum stops in front of the fridge and puts her hands on her hips. Do you know her? I ask. Of her, yes. She was 5 or 6 years younger, but her family went to the club. Darling, you know Lady Salisbury. She plays Black Maria with me. She'll be here tonight. I do know Lady Salisbury. She's probably my grandmother's age, but she hangs out with my mother's set. She tells bawdy jokes and always encourages everyone to eat more cake. Would she tell me about her daughter? Dear magic, Agatha, no, what a thing to ask. Everyone knows her daughter was a scandal, and her son was a dud. What kind of scandal? Well, Lucy ran off, just a few years out of Watford. She was the Salisbury's pride and joy, and then she ran off with some man. I heard it was a normal, maybe even an American. Ruth, Lady Salisbury, broke down at a charity do, a lawn bowling tournament for stutterers, and confessed to Natalie Brain that she was worried there might be a child involved, an illegitimate child. That's the last Ruth's ever spoken of it. No one's seen Lucy, not in our realm, since school. Lucy disappeared, I say. Worse, Mum says. She ran away. From magic. Can you imagine? Yes, I say. Then, no. My mother brushes non-existent crumbs from her hands. Get changed, darling. The guests will be here any minute. I start to walk out of the kitchen, and Mum hands me a stack of hand-embroidered napkins to give to Helen on my way through the dining room. I hand them to Helen without saying anything. I'm too busy thinking. I knew Lucy Salisbury, Helen says. We went to school together. It's quite like Helen to wait until my mother isn't in the room to speak to me. My mother prefers a more formal relationship, but Helen has always treated me like family. Not close family, more like a niece. I think she prefers Simon. Lucy was a few years older, Helen says. All the girls in my year went mad when we heard she'd run away. We thought it was so romantic and terrifying. Did she really run away? That's what we heard. Met a man and took off. for California. California? I used to think of her, Helen says, with that long blonde hair lying out on the sand. I climb into bed without changing into my party clothes and pull out the stolen photo, holding it above me. Lucy Salisbury ran away from magic. She was dating the most powerful living mage, the guy who was about to take over the world, and she just ran away. Professor Bunce said Lucy was a powerful magician in her own right. She could have been the first lady of magic. Or maybe she could have ruled beside the mage, and she walked away. Was there a baby? Did she take the baby with her? Maybe she's raising him in the normal world. Maybe that's the gift Lucy Salisbury gave herself and her child, not to have to grow up with all this shit. Not to have the mage as his dad, and a world at war for its inheritance. That kid got off, and Simon got stuck with it instead.
69. Lucy.
I was happy. I loved him, and he was always more good than bad. He's still more good than bad, I think. It just goes to show how much of both a person can hold. We were together by the time we left Watford. Davy had a cottage he'd inherited from his grandmother, and I followed him there. I lied to my parents. They never liked Davy. He spent most of his time reading in those days and writing letters and pamphlets that he'd send to magical scholars. He never felt like seeing friends or just going out. I remember we went to London once to have dinner with Mitali and Martin to meet their little boy. I wore a long peasant skirt, and I'd spelled flowers into my hair, and I was so happy to see them, to see Mitali. At first it was good. We were drinking red wine, and I was curled up in a big papasan chair, and Davy started talking to Mitali about the coven. She was campaigning for a seat.
"You won't change anything,"
he said.
"Nothing will change."
"Well, I know you think so," she said. "I've read your papers."
"Have you?"
That perked him up. He leaned forward in his chair, dangling his wine glass between his knees.
"Then you know that the only answer is revolution."
"I know that things will only get better if good people fight for what's important."
"And you think the coven cares about good people and what's important? You think Natasha Grimpitch cares about your idealism?"
"No," Mitali said. "But if I'm on the coven, I'll have as many votes as she does." Davy laughed.
"The names on the coven haven't changed in 200 years. Only the faces. They might as well carve Pitch onto the headmaster's chair at Watford. All they care about, all any of them care about, is protecting their own power."
Mitali wasn't cowed. In her wide-legged jeans and her wine-coloured velvet jacket, her hair falling to her shoulder blades in messy dark curls, she's the one who looked like a radical. "They're protecting all our power," she said. "The whole world of mages."
"Are they?" Davy said. "Ask Natasha Grimpitch about suicide rates among low magicians. Ask your coven what they're doing to fight pixie sticks and every other magical disease that doesn't affect their own sons and daughters."
"How is a revolution going to help the pixies?" Mitali huffed. "How is throwing aside centuries of tradition and institutional knowledge going to help any of us?"
"We'll build better traditions,"
Davy shouted. I don't think he realized he was shouting. "We'll write new rules, in blood."
"If need be, yes. Yes, Mitali. Does that frighten you?"
We left shortly after that. I said I had a headache. Davy was still flushed from the wine, but he wouldn't let me drive. He didn't notice me casting Stay the Course on him from the passenger seat. We never went back to London after that. We rarely left the cottage. We didn't have a phone or a television. I bought chickens from the farmer down the road and spelled them not to wander away. I wrote long letters to my mother, all fiction. Davy stayed inside most days with his books. I called them his books, but they were all stolen from Watford. He'd go back and take more whenever he needed them. He was so powerful. He could make himself nearly invisible. Sometimes, Davy would go away for a few days at a time to meet with other magical activists, but he always came back more dispirited than when he left. He gave up on a revolution. No one read his papers. He gave up on everything except the greatest mage. I think Davy must have been the greatest mage scholar in the history of magic. He knew every prophecy by heart. He wrote them on the stone walls of our cottage and diagrammed their sentences. And when I brought him his meals, he might ask for my opinion. What did I think this metaphor meant? Had I ever considered that interpretation? I remember a morning when I interrupted him to bring him eggs and oatmeal. Crowley, we ate so much oatmeal, which I was also feeding to the chickens. You can extend food with magic. You can make food out of pillows and candles. You can call birds down from the sky and deer in from the fields. But sometimes there's nothing. Sometimes there was just nothing. Lucy, he said. His eyes were lit from the inside. He'd been up all night. Good morning, Davy. Eat something.
Lucy, I think I cracked it.
He wrapped his arm around my hips and pulled me closer to his chair. And I loved him then.
What if the oracles kept having the same visions because they weren't prophecies at all? What if they were instructions? Lucy, what if they're meant to guide us to change, not foretell it? Here we are, just waiting to be saved, but the prophecies tell us how to save ourselves.
How?
With the greatest mage.
He left again. He came back with more books. He came back with pots of oil and blood that wasn't red. I'm not sure when he slept, not with me. I went for long walks in the fields. I thought about writing letters to Mitali, but I knew she'd fly here on a broom if I told her the truth, and I wasn't ready to go. I never wanted to leave Davy. So much of this is his fault. I want you to be angry with him, but I never asked to leave. I never asked him to let me go. I thought that whatever was coming would be better if I was there with him. I thought it helped him to be tied to me, like a kite with a string. I thought that as long as I was there, he'd never get carried away completely. He killed both my chickens. He crawled into our bed one night, smelling of mud and burnt plastic, and lifted my hair to kiss the back of my neck.
Lucy.
I rolled over to see him. He was smiling. He looked young, like someone had wiped the bitterness from his face with a warm cloth.
I got it,
he said, kissing my cheeks and my forehead.
The great mage, Lucy. We can bring him.
I laughed. I was just so happy to see him happy. I was so happy to have his attention. How, Davy?
Just like this.
I shook my head. I didn't understand. He pushed me onto my back, kissing along my neck.
The two of us. We'll make him.
He kept kissing my neck down to my nightshirt. Are you talking about a baby, Davy? He pulled his head up and grinned.
Who better than us?
He said.
To raise our savior. Book 4. 70. Nicodemus. She won't talk to me. Hasn't since, because it's against the rules. She wasn't so concerned with the rules when we were kids. Made our own rules, didn't we? We were so brute. Who was going to stop us? I'll never forget the time Ebenezer spelled the drawbridge down so the three of us could go into town and get pissed. The look on the headmistress's face when she caught her own sister sneaking back in legless. Fiona could never hold her cider.
Mistress Pitch was steaming, standing on the lawn in a dressing gown and 9 months up the duff. Eb lost her wand for a week because she was the one who snuck us out. And then the next night, Eb spelled the bridge down with my wand. We could always use each other's pieces. Gutty as fuck she was. Of course we got caught again. Getting away with it wasn't the point. The point was that we were young and free and full of magic. What was Mistress Pitch going to do? Toss out her own sister and the two strongest magicians at Watford? They weren't going to toss out Ebenezer. They were too worried she'd go rogue on them. Too worried she'd realize she could do more with all that magic than stick the desks to the ceilings. Or call every shaggy dog in the county to Watford like she was the Pied Piper. I realized what Eb could do. What I could do. I get to our street and cut down the alley, then let myself into the back garden. The gate creaks. I'm a few minutes early. Eb'll be inside still. I make my way over to the willow tree and sit down on Mum's bench. Wish I could have a fag. Gave 'em up when I crossed over, almost 20 years ago. For that pitch brat blew smoke in my face and now I've got a taste for it again. Fee and I used to roll her own on menthol papers. Ebenezer wouldn't have any of it. Said tobacco gunked up her magic.
Your sister's trying to stay pure,
Fiona would tease.
Like an athlete, like Princess Di.
We used to give Eb hell over being a virgin. Hell, she's probably still a virgin. Does feeling up other girls even count? The back door opens and I look up. But it ain't Eb. Just somebody, no one I recognise, stepping out for a smoke. I close my eyes and inhale. This vampire nose is good for something. Eb will come out soon, and she'll walk into the garden and lean against the gate. And she won't talk to me. That's the agreement. That's the rule. She'll just talk. She'll tell the wind how she's doing. She'll catch the Christmas moon up on all the family goings on. Sometimes she might do magic. Not for me. Just for the sake of it. Anything alive comes out to say hello to Eb, even in the dead of winter. Last year, a deer pranced up the alley, cash anything, and rested its head in Ebenezer's hands. I knifed and drained it as soon as Eb went back in. I think she knew that I would. Maybe it was a gift. Maybe she was trying to keep me pure for a day. Anyway, I had to haul the deer's body a mile before I found a bin big enough for it. Eb will come out soon, and she'll talk, and I'll listen. I don't talk at all. Don't think Eb would want that. It would be too much like a conversation, too close to breaking the rules. Plus, what would I say? I've got nothing to report that she wants to hear. No news that won't turn her stomach. All Ebenezer really wants to know is that I'm still here, such as I am. Mostly my sister talks about the school, the grounds, the goats, the kids, that dryad she's been mooning over since sixth year. She doesn't talk about the mage. Eb's never been one for politics. I expect she stays out of his way. Though she told me once that they got into a royal dust-up when one of his merewolves ate one of her goats. I've never seen the merewolves, only heard about them from Eb. It's the only animal I've ever known her not to like. She says they try to throw themselves up on the drawbridge, that the bridge shakes while the children and goats are crossing it. One of the wolves actually made it out once, dragged itself round the lawn snarling until Eb came and cast it back into the water. I spell them to sleep. Now when the bridge is down, she told me, they sink to the bottom of the moat. Whoever it was came out for a fag, finishes it and goes back in, slamming the screen door shut. I was early, but now Ebenezer's late. Real late. We're flirting with sunrise now. The noise has stopped inside the house. The kids will be in bed. Eb says all our brothers and our little sister have kittens these days. I never thought about having any of my own before I crossed over. I think about it now. Me and Fee. Couple of sprogs. Her family would have had a fit if she'd settled down with me. Guess she was never going to settle down with no one. I know where Fee is now. Our paths would cross if I let them. Don't fancy she wants to hear anything I have to say either. Eb's late. Maybe she forgot. Not like her to forget. Never has in all these years. Can't call her. Don't even know if she has a mobile these days. I stand and pace a bit under the tree. Normally, Eb casts a spell so that no one sees me. I'm antsy. I creep up closer to the house. If anyone's up, I should be able to hear them. The house is dark. One of the kitchen windows is cracked, but I can't smell dinner. Eb says she helps Mum with the cooking now. Roasted gammon it'll be, and bread and butter pudding. Eb usually brings me out a plate. I go up the back steps and peek inside the window in the door. The kitchen is empty. I can't hear anything. I twist the knob, not expecting it to turn, but it does, and the door gives. I step forward gingerly, not sure whether I'll be allowed. But the house accepts me. And I stand there for a moment, feeling right sorry for myself and my mum's kitchen. I smell the child before I see her. She's hiding behind the doorway, peeking out at me.
Is that you, Auntie?
Auntie? I say. Do I look like somebody's auntie?
I thought you were my Aunt Eb. You look like her.
She's a little blonde one in a red plaid nightgown. Must be my sister Lavinia's. She was much older than this herself last time I saw her. I'm family, I say. I come to talk to Eb. Why don't you go get her for me? She won't be mad. Not the girl, anyway.
Auntie Eb's gone,
the chick says.
She left with the mage. Grandmum's still crying. We didn't even have Christmas.
The mage, I say.
Himself,
the girl says.
I heard everybody say it. Mum says Auntie Eb was arrested.
Arrested? For what?
I don't know. I guess she broke a rule.
I stare at the child. She stares back. Then I turn for the door.
Where are you going?
She calls after me. To find your auntie.
71. Simon. I wake up hungry, and not until I'm awake do I realise that it's not me who's hungry. The air is dry and itching, pulling at my skin, pulling with needles, pricking at me. I sit up and shake my head. The feeling doesn't go away. I take a deep breath, and then it's inside my lungs too, like sand, like ground glass. The humdrum. I look over at Baz's bed. The sheets and blankets are cast aside. He's not there. I stumble to my feet and out of the room, standing in the blood-dark hallway. Baz, I whisper. No one answers. I follow the bad feeling down the hallway, down the stairs to the front door of the manor. The night sky and the snow are so bright, there's light streaming into the foyer. I open the door and run out into the snow. The feeling is stronger out here. Worse. Almost like I'm standing inside one of the humdrum's dead spots. But when I reach for my magic, it's still there. It rises to the surface of my skin and hums in my fingertips. It pools in my mouth. I try to force it down again. I follow the itchy feeling forward. I should go back inside. I should put on shoes. I find myself running towards the private forest that sweeps along the side of the Pitch's house like a curtain. I'm wearing Baz's red and gold striped pajamas, and they're wet to my thighs. The hungry feeling gets stronger with every step. It sucks at me. I feel my magic slipping out, sliding around my skin. A tree branch drags against me and catches fire. I keep pushing forward. I don't know where I'm going. I've never been in this forest before. Plus, there's no space between the trees. I'm not on a path. There isn't a clearing. When I hear him laughing,
I stop so abruptly that my magic sloshes forward, spilling up over the sides of me. He's right there, leaning against one of the trees. Him. The insidious humdrum. Me.
Hello, he says, tossing his ball in the air. He catches it, frowns at me for a second, then tucks the ball into the pocket of his jeans.
You can talk, I say.
I can now, he says. I can do all sorts of things now.
He reaches out to a small shoot branching out of the tree trunk, and his hand passes through it. He grimaces and tries again. This time, his hand closes around the twig and he snaps it off. Then he looks back up at me and grins, like I should be proud of him.
Why do you look like me?
I shout. This still feels like the most important question.
This is just what I look like, he laughs. Why wouldn't I look like you?
But you're not me.
No.
The humdrum frowns.
Look at you. You're different every time I see you. But I always look just like this.
The twig is still in his hands. He breaks it in two, then drops it and steps towards me.
You can do all sorts of things I can't do.
I step back into a tangle of branches.
Why are you here?
What do you want from me?
Nothing, he says. Nothing. Nothing. Nothing.
But what does he want from you?
That's the real question.
I hear someone groan. There's something moving in the trees. I wish I could see better. And as soon as I wish it, my magic gets brighter. I'm glowing. The humdrum laughs again.
Simon! Someone calls.
I think it's Baz, but he sounds wrong, like he's out of breath or in pain.
Baz? Are you okay?
No. No.
Simon!
And then I see Baz ahead of me, 20 feet or so, leaning against a tree. The humdrum is above us now, sitting on a low branch, watching. Baz's head hangs low. I rush forward.
Baz!
He lifts his face, and it's wrong too. Twisted. His eyes are dilated and black, and his mouth is full of white knives. His lips have pulled back to make room for them. I should back away. But instead, I squeeze between the trees to try to get to him. It's Baz who backs away from me.
Something's wrong, he says. I'm hungry.
Baz, you're always hungry.
No, it's different.
He shakes his head and shoulders like an animal.
I saw you in the forest, he says, just now, but you were young. You look like you did the very first time I saw you.
His words are slurred, like he's shoving them through his teeth.
I thought for a minute that you were dead. I thought it was a visiting.
It wasn't me. I take a step towards him.
You saw the humdrum.
You touched me, he says. I leaned down, and you put your hand on my face.
It isn't me, I say.
And then you pushed it into me.
He stumbles backwards, staying a step away from me.
Like you do, Simon.
But it wasn't magic this time.
It was a void. You pushed a void into me, and everything else left to make room.
Baz, stop. Let me help you.
He keeps shaking his head. He reminds me for a moment of the red dragon, swinging her head back and forth.
It's easy with creatures,
the humdrum says. He's standing behind Baz now. He reaches out and presses a hand onto Baz's hunched spine.
I just take what I got and give it to them.
Baz whines and unfolds until his back is arched.
What?
I demand. What do you give them? The humdrum shrugs.
Nothing. I give them some of my nothing.
Baz lifts his face to me, all pupil and fang. He takes a step forward.
Get away, Simon. I'm hungry.
I give them some of my nothing,
the humdrum says again.
and then they're drawn to the biggest of all somethings. You. And then you give me more nothing. It's a great game.
Baz keeps coming for me. I stand my ground.
Get away, Simon. I'm hungry.
What are you hungry for, Baz?
For you,
he shouts.
For magic. For blood. For magic. For everything. For you. For magic.
He's shaking his head so fast it blurs. There's a tree between us, and Baz rips it from the ground and tosses it aside.
Wicked, the humdrum says. I've never tried it with one of these before.
Baz ploughs into me like a steel griffin. I catch him in my arms and roll to the ground. He's much stronger than I am, but I'm made of magic right now, so there's no crushing me. We thrash around on the ground. I hold his head in both my hands, pushing his jaw away.
I'm so hungry, he whines, and you're so full.
You can have it, I say, trying to look in his eyes.
Baz, you know you can have it.
I push on his chin and grab at his hair, holding him back, but I let my magic go. I let it flow into him from my every pore. Baz sobs and abruptly stops fighting. It feels like I'm pouring water into an empty well. It goes, and it goes. Baz's body sags against mine.
Wow, the humdrum says. That's even better than fighting.
He feels close. I look up, and he's standing right over us, rock solid in the moonlight.
When did you learn to do that? It's like you turned on a tap.
Did you take his magic? I shout at the humdrum.
Did I take his magic?
He repeats, like it's a hilarious question.
No, I don't take anything. I'm just what's left when you're done.
He grins, like a cat with a canary, and it's an expression I've never seen on my own face.
Simon!
Baz is shouting beneath me. I look down. He's glowing now, too. His fangs are gone, but he still looks like he's in pain. He's squeezing my triceps.
Enough!
I let go of him and roll away, but the magic is still pouring out of me, through me. It is like a tap. I concentrate on turning it off. When it feels like it's staying inside me again, when I stop glowing, I get up on my hands and knees.
Baz?
Here, he says. I move towards his voice.
Are you okay?
I think so. He's lying on the ground. I just feel a bit burnt.
Are you on fire?
No, he says. No. Burnt on the inside. I look around, but I don't see the humdrum, or hear him, or feel him sucking at my breath.
Is he gone?
Baz asks.
Seems like it.
I collapse next to him.
Are you okay?
I'm fine. Baz gropes for me with his arm, and when he feels me, he wraps his arm around my neck and shoulders, weakly pulling me towards him. I move closer until my head falls on his chest.
Are you okay?
He asks again.
Yeah.
You?
Tip top.
He coughs, and I push my face into his chest.
What was that?
Baz asks. The humdrum.
Simon, are you the insidious humdrum?
No.
Are you sure?
Baz, I feel burnt out. Incinerated. That kid.
It was Simon.
Emptied me out somehow. Like he pressed my magic out or down.
And then Simon filled me up again with his fire. I feel like a phoenix rebirthed itself in my lower intestines.
Simon's hiding his face in my chest and I hold him tighter. It was Simon. Like seeing him again for the very first time. Crap jeans and dirty t-shirt, that rawness in his skin, that hunger in his eyes. When I saw him step out from between the pines tonight, I wanted to kick him in the knees. It was definitely Simon. Simon, the grown one, is trembling, so I wrap my other arm around him too. My arms feel hollow, but Simon feels solid through. Simon Snow is the humdrum. Or, the humdrum is Simon Snow. Simon.
Did I take his magic? No, I don't take anything. I'm just what's left when you're done.
I'm lying on Baz, and he has both arms around me, and I keep trying to shake the humdrum's face out of my head. To shake my face off his head.
I give them some of my nothing, and then you give me more nothing.
I sit up and rub my eyes. Do you still need to hunt? No, Baz says. I was finishing up when he found me. I move into a crouch, then stand, holding out my hand to him. Did he say anything before he attacked you? Baz takes my hand and pulls himself up. He doesn't let go. He said, "You'll do." I close my eyes and my head drops forward. He used you. He used you against me. Everyone does, Baz says softly. I feel his arm slide slowly, gently back around my waist. I slouch into him. I'm sorry. Baz, if Simon Snow is the humdrum, that makes him a villain, a supervillain. Can I be in love with a supervillain? Simon. Baz is shaking, and I think he might be crying, which would make sense after what just happened. I open my eyes and lift up my chin. He's not crying. He's laughing. He's laughing so hard he's falling against me. What's wrong with you? I ask. Are you in shock? You're the humdrum. I'm not, I say, trying to push him back by the shoulders. I'm dead, not blind, Snow. You're the humdrum. That wasn't me. Why are you laughing? Baz keeps laughing, but he's also giving me a sneery grin. I'm laughing because you're the chosen one, he says giddily. But you're also the greatest threat to magic. You're a bad guy. Baz, I swear, that wasn't me. Looks like you, sounds like you, tosses that infernal red ball up in the air like you. He holds me tighter. I think I'd know if I were the insidious humdrum, I say. I wouldn't give you that much credit, Simon. You're exceedingly thick and criminally good-looking. Have I mentioned that? No. He leans in like he's going to bite me and kisses me instead. It's so good. It's been so good every time. I pull away. I'm not the humdrum. But why does thinking so make you want to kiss me? Everything makes me want to kiss you. Haven't you worked that out yet? Crowley, you're thick. He kisses me again and is laughing again. I'm not the humdrum, I repeat when I get the chance. I'd know if I were. What you are is a fucking tragedy, Simon Snow. You literally couldn't be a bigger mess. He tries to kiss me, but I hold back. And you like that? I love it, he says. Why? Because we match. We make our way out of the forest. Baz knows the way. It really is stocked with deer just for him. It doesn't creep me out at all to know that. Apparently I can get used to anything. Apparently he can too. That thing, I try again, isn't me.
Maybe it's you in the past, he says. Maybe you're a time traveler. But wouldn't I remember it if he's me when I was a kid?
I don't know how time travel works,
Baz says. It's not magic. You're not limping, I say. He looks down and shakes out his leg.
It feels better, he says. Crowley Snow, you've healed me.
I wonder if I'm still a vampire. I raise my eyebrows and he laughs.
Calm down, miracle boy. I'm still a vampire. You still smell like bacon and homemade cinnamon buns.
How can I smell like bacon and homemade cinnamon buns?
You smell like something I'd gladly eat.
Baz stops and holds an arm out in front of me.
Wait, do you feel that?
I stop too.
It's faint, but it's there, that parched feeling, that scratch in the back of my throat.
The humdrum, Baz says. Is he back? There's shouting ahead of us, somebody screaming Baz's name. I hold my hand above my hip, trying to call my blade. It doesn't come. I can't feel my magic anywhere.
Baz has his wand tucked into his pajamas, of course he does. He whips it out and tries to cast a spell. Nothing happens. He tries again.
It's a dead spot, I whisper. It's one of the humdrum's dead spots.
Basilton?
Baz's stepmother is screaming and running towards us. She's wearing her nightgown and her hair is down.
Malcolm, he's here!
The humdrum. Baz looks over at me, as pale as I've ever seen him, his face chalky and white in the moonlight.
Snow. Run.
What?
Go, he says. You did this.
72. Simon.
I could probably walk to London, if I were wearing shoes, and if there weren't all this snow.
When Baz told me to go, when he blamed a dead spot on me, I wanted to argue, but his parents were running towards us, and they were panicking, and I couldn't tell what was happening. Had the hole swallowed up their entire house, their whole estate? I tried to run back into the forest, but it was on fire, from me, from my magic, and I couldn't do anything to stop it because now I didn't have any.
Go,
Baz said again. So I did. I ran. I got to the drive, and my feet were going numb from cold, but I kept running. Down the long, long drive, to the road, away from him. I'm still running. My magic comes back to me all at once and sends me to the ground, shaking. If only I had my wand, or a mobile. I could hitchhike. Would anyone pick me up? Would anyone be driving down this road in the middle of nowhere, Hampshire, in the middle of the night, on Christmas Eve? Father Christmas isn't real. The Tooth Fairy is. I'm kneeling in the snow at the side of the road. I can do this, I think. I've done this before. I just have to want it. I have to need it. I think about getting away, about getting to Penny. I think about my magic filling me up and shooting out my shoulders. And then I feel them tearing through Baz's pajamas. Wide, bony wings. There are no feathers this time. I must have been thinking about the dragon. These wings are red and leathery with grey spikes at the hinges. They spread out as soon as I think about them and pull me up out of the snow. I tear off the remains of my flannel shirt, and I don't think about how to fly. I just think about where I want to go. Up, away, and it happens. It's colder up here, so I think about being warm, and my skin starts to flicker with heat. Baz's house is below me now, in the distance. The fire I started is still burning. I watch the smoke pouring out of the forest and try to move closer, but I can't. I'm made of magic, and there's no magic there anymore. I hover in the sky. I think about putting out the fire. The clouds are full of freezing rain, so I think about pushing them toward the forest, and they go. And then I think about Baz telling me to go. So I do.
and then I stop thinking.
73. Penelope. My little sister Priya was the one to get the doll. She was waiting up for Father Christmas and doing a hell of a job too. She made it until 4 in the morning. I think she outlasted Mum and Dad. Priya heard the knocking and thought that it was Father Christmas himself. We don't have a fireplace. She must have thought he had to come through the front door. When she opened the door, Simon fell in and she screamed. I don't blame her. He looked like Satan incarnate. Massive red and black wings, a red tail with a black spade at the end. He'd cast some sort of spell on himself that made him glow yellow and orange, and he was covered in snow and debris, wearing the filthiest, fanciest pajama bottoms. Mum and Dad heard Priya scream and came thumping down the stairs. Mum screamed too, and then Dad shouted, and then apparently he had to keep Mum from throwing curses. She thought Simon was possessed or enchanted or that he'd gone full Lucifer. The rest of us came running down the stairs then, except for Premal, who didn't come home, even for Christmas. And I saw Simon and ran to him. It didn't occur to me to be scared of him. And that snapped Mum and Dad back to normal. Mum started casting warming spells, and Dad got a bowl of hot water and a cloth to clean Simon up. We ended up putting him in the shower. He was so exhausted, he could hardly stand up. He couldn't even tell us where he'd been. I assumed he'd made it back to Baz's house, but I didn't want my parents to know that we'd left Simon on the road in the middle of the countryside on Christmas Eve. I helped my mum and dad give him a shower, and nobody cared that I was seeing him naked. Then we put him in some of Mum's trackies, and she tried to tuck his tail down one leg. I kept casting nonsense until my mum told me to shut up. "It's not working, Penny, but I worked the last time."
"Maybe it's not a spell," Dad said. "Maybe he transformed."
"Maybe he evolved," Priya said from the bathroom doorway. "Like a Pokemon."
"Go to bed, Priya," Dad said.
"I'm waiting for Father Christmas."
"Go to bed," Mum shouted.
Mum was casting spells too. "As you were," and "back to start."
"Careful, Mitali,"
Dad said.
"You'll turn him into a baby."
But none of Mum's spells touched Simon. She tried casting spells in Hindi, too. She doesn't speak Hindi, but my great-grandmother did. Nothing worked. They put Simon in my bed, and Dad thought they should call the mage, but Mum said they should wait to see what Simon wanted them to do. Simon seemed conscious, but he wasn't saying anything, and he wouldn't make eye contact. My parents were still arguing about it after they left my room and shut the door.
"Go to bed, Priya,"
my father shouted. I climbed onto the bed next to Simon and laid my ring hand over his red wings. "Nonsense," I whispered. "Nonsense."